Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Perhaps you saw this piece in the New York Times on April 20th. The title is Teach the Books, Touch the Heart. And our guest this hour, Claire Nidell Hollander, who's been working as a reading enrichment teacher in a New York City public middle school for some years, laments the emphasis on testing and the pressure that she feels to bring scores up. She has had to cut two of her three classic book groups and replace them with a test preparation tutorial program. Only those students who perform well can stay in the reading classes. And yet, as we all know, works of literature can really change our lives and certainly touch our hearts. Her students have read classic works like Of Mice and Men, Sounder, The Red Pony, A Raisin in the Sun, Lord of the Flies, The Catcher in the Rye, Romeo and Juliet, and Macbeth, and many other great works. The multiple choice tests, she writes, which use data to inform instruction, ignore the students' hearts. To encourage a lifelong love of reading, we should not only read the classics, but also perhaps abandon multiple choice and move toward extensive written exams. Claire is with us this hour of the program. She's also a writer, a fairly new development in her life. She writes young adult fiction, and she says that the school in which she teaches is founded on a collaborative teaching model, meaning that teachers work in grade teams, and there is a great deal of co-planning and co-teaching, which is an environment she thoroughly enjoys. I suspect we're going to receive a lot of phone calls on this issue. I know there are a lot of people in the teaching profession who listen, and there are all of you listening are great readers, so you will be able to talk about great works of literature and the importance they have in your lives as well. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Claire is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Claire, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I love the article that you wrote. It just captured my fancy right off the bat. And I thought, yes, we just need to talk about this issue because I really believe we need to read great works of literature. And as you know better than anybody, it really can touch our hearts and I'm sure changes many of your students' lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I have students, you know, come visit years later, eager to talk about the books we read together and the impact they had on them, especially as they started high school. So, it's part of my job that I really find exciting and enjoyable every day.
And yet you're worried that you won't be able to continue this. You've had to cut some of these classes because of our emphasis on testing, and we don't test great works of literature. You can't do it in a multiple-choice exam.
No, not currently. I mean, the biggest problem with the multiple-choice exams is that they're really not they don't correlate with any in-school curriculum. The knowledge they test is global. It's world knowledge and word knowledge that a child may have encountered in school or even more likely encountered outside of school that they're being tested on. So that's a big issue for us as teachers, and which is what leads us to do the test prep, because we can prepare the kids for the test by giving them practice, but it's a very difficult test to teach to.
Right. Before we talk more extensively about that, let's talk about the great works that you're reading. Some would say, oh my goodness, you're reading this in middle school. What a challenge for young people. You're reading some works that require a great deal of thought.
And, you know, some of the content is actually, pretty shocking for 7th and 8th graders when they read Of Mice and Men, for instance. And even Catcher in the Rye, or really especially Catcher in the Rye, remains shocking to middle school students. But they have amazing stamina for dealing with the language complexity because they know that the works are famous and they feel important and special when they read them, especially Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. And don't you find that at that time of life, and certainly into high school, but I think it starts in middle school, you really are taking on the big questions of life as you develop your own life, as you think about who you are and who your family is and what your future is, what life is, what death is, all of those big, big questions.
Well, absolutely, and that's why I have chosen the books that I listed in the article. They're chosen because they all deal with those universal themes.
Yes.
So Of Mice and Men is really about isolation. It's really about social loneliness, and that really resonates for kids. Romeo and Juliet is about love, but it's also about family conflict. Which the kids, of course, relate to.
How do you choose what books you will, and do they change from year to year, what books your students will be reading?
They do change from year to year, but I have certain go-to books. And making that selection, it's not easy. If it's a book that I'm really going to read out loud, for the most part, and that kids are going to share in the reading, it can't be too long. And so I think Sounder, Of Mice and Men have worked very well in that forum. Some of the books I choose, the kids do read some chapters at home. And so I've read Lord of the Flies that way, where we read some sections in class and some sections out of class. And I've done Catcher in the Rye that way as well. But for instance, when we do Shakespeare, it's all read together. It's a completely communal experience. I use some support in the classroom with Shakespeare. Sometimes we watch scenes from movies, and we use No Fear Shakespeare online, which is very helpful in just translating the language sometimes.
What's that called? No Fear Shakespeare?
It's No Fear Shakespeare. I think it's a Spark Notes software. But I don't think it's cheating to watch the movies, because these are plays after all. They're supposed to be visual.
Right. And why do you read aloud? What's the difference?
Well, there is the communal experience that I think is really important for the kids, so that we're sharing this text. The adult and the adolescent are having the same experience at the same time. I think one of the things about adolescence is you feel like, you know, there's this wall of silence between you and many of the adults in your life about the most important experiences you're having, or about your hopes for the future or your fears. So when you share a text like Of Mice and Men, where you're really talking about what it means to be isolated, what it means to lose your dream, I think it's really important to have that experience with an adult and to see how the text moves the adult as well. And then there's a more practical purpose for reading out loud, which is the kids do need to get these words into their own lexicon. They need to own the vocabulary themselves. And if they're not saying the words, they're not really owning them. So I like to have them read Round Robin some of the time, and some of the time they listen, and some of the time we discuss.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever have any problems getting discussions started, and how do you start the discussions?
Actually, usually I have problems getting the discussions to stop. sometimes I think they're having a little bit too much fun. That doesn't really happen. I mean, there's books that have longer sections of descriptive language, you know, of pure description. So there's times when you're reading Lord of the Flies and they're just climbing up and down the mountain. And, you know, you keep saying to them, don't worry, we'll get through this, and there'll be a huge payoff and it'll be a really exciting end. And they are always, you know, kind of jumping out of their chairs at the end. So I would say the biggest challenge with reading out loud, if you're really going to make the whole experience communal and you're going to read the entire book out loud, a book like Of Mice and Men or a book like Sounder that's fairly compact and is action-filled, or reading plays work very well in that style. I mean, Steinbeck wrote of Mice and Men thinking, you know, it was practically a play, and it does read like that. There's action in every scene.
When you think back to your own middle school years or high school years, Claire, what great works of literature stayed with you, were most important to you?
Well, I vividly remember reading The Red Pony when I was in eighth grade, and it wasn't that I had a teacher who was a stellar teacher, but I remember being really moved by the story and the symbolism of the pony and this feeling that this child was having an experience that would change him forever. And I don't remember clearly understanding that there was this problem in his relationship with his father, but there was definitely this mood or tone of despair. And I think as an eighth grader, I really related to that, a sort of unspoken despair, a despair that's difficult to describe. I think it's a feeling that 13-year-olds have about their lives. So that resonated with me. And of course, you know, your first encounter with Shakespeare and Shakespearean language tends to stay with you.
Yes. I think it's interesting that you've become a writer as well. Maybe you've done so much reading that it's easier for you to be a writer.
Well, actually, I think I think that actually is true. I came to teaching as a second career. I was in publishing first, and prior to that, I got my my master's in poetry from Brown. So I started out as a poet, and that's not a paying occupation. And then I worked in publishing for 6 or 7 years. And then I felt like I really wanted to engage more. When you're working in publishing, I worked for a literary agent. It's a fascinating job. It's a great career. But I missed the sort of closeness to the text that I thought I would get in teaching, and I have found that in teaching. And then I did switch to writing fiction, and I do think teaching made me feel like, you know, taking these risks, something I encourage my students to do every day, mm-hmm. and that, you know, as an adult, you have to keep taking them as well, and just put yourself out there and see what you can do.
Now, tell me a little bit more about how things have changed since we, school districts, schools all over the country, feel this enormous pressure for a whole host of reasons to have their students perform well on these standardized tests. How you measure reading comprehension, it doesn't really jive with studying great works of literature when it comes to these tests, does it?
Not when it comes to these specific tests. I mean, when I started teaching 14 years ago, we had these exams. And we also, in New York State, we also gave a fairly extensive written exam that teachers actually graded themselves, which I always found to be an excellent assessment tool. I never found the data that I got from the standardized tests to be all that informative, because it's organized by skill type, like finding the main idea or making predictions. And I don't really believe that these are discrete verbal skills that people possess. It's very dependent upon the passage that you've read and whether you have the world knowledge to understand the passage and whether you have the word knowledge to understand the passage. So because these standardized tests test such global knowledge, and they're not tied to curriculum, virtually anything could be on the test. And that's what makes them not fantastic assessment tools for growth. They do give us a baseline of a child's world knowledge and word knowledge for that particular exam. So you can see how they performed in relation to their peers on that particular exam. So the data isn't useless, but to show growth year by year, I think even the test makers themselves doubt that can be demonstrated if the tests are not tied to curriculum as it's taught in schools. So this is a huge problem that's been recognized by educators and test makers alike for years. Still, this is the tool that we have at our disposal. People are used to them. People like the raw number. They like the data that comes from their use. And so we're sort of stuck with, you know, what I think is essentially a pseudoscience when it comes to using these tools to assess student growth within a year.
And you have had to, it's my understanding, eliminate a couple of your reading classes and do and focus instead on preparing students to do well on the test.
Well, the tests really make, they have a huge impact on that. The teachers are actually being ranked by how their students do, and this data is being made public. So, of course, the teachers are concerned. But for the kids here in New York City, the tests have an impact on where they get into high school.
Oh.
So this is a very meaningful exam for our students. So if they aren't performing well compared to their peers, it has a huge impact on our school and on the kids' lives.
So how should we be testing the students?
Well, I think first you have to take a step back. You have to ask yourself the question: what are we testing them on now? So we kind of take it on faith that the tests are meaningful, that the data is useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first very basic question you have to ask is: What are we learning about each child when we give them these tests year after year? And it's very well established that these test scores correlate with the education level of the child's parents. So that's the first piece. I think we have a lot of children who are beginning school with deficits in both world knowledge and word knowledge. And that's real, and it's our job as educators to help close those gaps. But that's a very long road. And it would be very helpful, I think, for those children and their families and the educators who work with them if we defined the knowledge more specifically that we wanted them to know. Because right now we're testing them without defining the knowledge that they needed to have. They just sort of need to know everything that the test makers deem grade level. And they have formulas for determining text complexity for each grade level. However, they have no real way of knowing, you know, has a child been exposed to specific world knowledge or specific vocabulary? So English has, you know, an extensive vocabulary, and either the child encountered that kind of vocabulary or they didn't. And I'll give you an example. You know, on some of these tests, there'll be a passage that employs a lot of out-of-date slang, maybe from the 1960s. Well, if your parents sprinkle words like that into their oral lexicon, you've been exposed to that type of language. But if your parents are non-native speakers of English or don't speak like that, you've never heard these words before. So the deficits that kids have are very diffuse and hard to measure. If we defined the knowledge that we wanted students to have, for instance, if we said these six books should be read by every sixth grader and they should be familiar with all of the higher level vocabulary in these books, then we could test them on that vocabulary and excerpts from those books, and you could even do multiple choice type questions, and you would have a huge amount of material to test the children on, and you would still see a huge range of outcomes. But you would give children who begin school with deficits a fighting chance,
mm-hmm.
and we could reward their very hard work. Currently, you see students coming to school every day who do their homework every day, who are the most attentive students in the class every day, and yet the deficits they have persist year after year, because they came to school with them and the home life is not verbally rich in English.
Mm-hmm.
And those students may not show growth, even if they've read 25 books independently that year and done all their homework. because of the randomness of the testing. If those children were told, you read these 10 books, you master the vocabulary in these 10 books, you master the concepts in these 10 books, you master the literary concepts and the literary vocabulary that relates to these 10 books, those children would get the help they need. After-school programs could give targeted instruction. Parents would be empowered. Neighborhood libraries could help. Everybody could help. As it is now, you know, the best we can do is tell parents, oh, your child needs to read more. Well, you know, that's for a lot of people. They know that already. The library in their neighborhood isn't terrific. They're not going out and buying books all the time, and there's no books in the home. So they can take books home from school, but the support that they're able to get outside of school is scant. And I think it just feels too abstract for a lot of families to just tell them that their child should read more.
Right.
Especially if their child doesn't like to read.
So what happens when you bring what I think is a marvelous idea to the attention of the people who put together the tests, to the school boards? Do people listen to you seriously and think, well, maybe this is a better way?
Well, I think these ideas are beginning to gain traction. I'm certainly not the first one to put them forward. Well-known educators like E.D. Hirsch have been saying this for years. I think that within the culture, we're very accepting of the multiple choice tests because they've been around for a great deal of time. But they're being put to new uses. And I don't know about in Wisconsin, but here in New York, in this testing season, it's been particularly, the backlash against the test has been particularly intense because the publisher, Pearson, used one passage. I don't know if you heard about the now infamous pineapple passage.
No.
There was a No, you haven't?
No, I haven't. Tell me.
It's sort of worth it's worth Googling. There was a passage that was was taken from a Daniel Pinkwater book. I'm getting his name wrong, I think. But it was a nonsense fable, and it was based on the tortoise and the hare story. Except in this passage, the tortoise was a pineapple. And the pineapple challenged the hare to a race. And then the animals discussed, the pineapple must be up to something if it's going to challenge the hare to a race. So the pineapple must have something up its sleeve. And so the animals all bet on the pineapple to win. And then the pineapple just sort of became a pineapple again, stopped speaking. And it just sat there and it didn't race at all. And so the animals ate it. And then the moral of the story was pineapples don't have sleeves. Well, this got to the Daily News somehow. There were six questions on this piece of nonsense, and the Daily News published the whole passage and the questions that related to the passage. And, you know, the author himself said, there's no way you can answer these questions. There's no right answer because I deliberately wrote a piece of nonsense.
Oh, my goodness.
So they've had to throw out all six questions related to this passage. And what didn't come to light was the fact that this passage was the second passage on the test. I think it was supposed to be considered fairly easy, fairly straightforward for some reason. And I know students who spent 30 minutes on that passage, you know, kind of paralyzed by the uncertainty of it. You know, and even my students were asking me about it today because I was telling them about some grading that I had done for the state. So anyway, that was really silly. There were math questions that had no right answer. There were fourth grade passages that children had seen before on test prep materials. And I know that on the fifth grade test, this hasn't really come up in the press, but the fifth grade test had excerpts from novels that grade level children read all the time in fifth grade classrooms, and then they were excerpted on the test, which gave a clear advantage to students who had read those books.
Right.
So one of the things that happens here in New York, and I assume where you all are too, is that these tests are really crowded in secrecy. There's no openness whatsoever. So while teacher data reports are being made public, the public is sort of taking it on faith that these tests test something, and that that something has to do with what kids learn in school during the school year. But the public does not read these tests.
Maybe we should.
They don't know what they're talking about. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. I've been so absorbed in the story, we need to pause for just a moment, and we'll start taking your calls. Claire Nidell-Hollander is a middle school public school teacher in New York and author of the recent New York Times essay, Teach the Books, Touch the Heart. It was in the New York Times on Sunday, April 22nd, if you would like to read that. We're welcoming phone calls. We have a ton of calls coming in. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. And we'd like to get a discussion going on the Facebook page on this issue as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your calls, Tony in Madison. Hi, Tony.
Hi, you guys, super show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for calling.
It sounds like you're advocating for a student-centered way of teaching where the students kind of gain knowledge and understanding through doing things versus more of a teacher or adult-centered where the teacher says what the children should learn and the kids are supposed to just take it all in and put it back down on paper. My question is, does this type of teaching work overall, or does it take a special teacher? Are you a special teacher, or could this be recreated across the board?
Am I a special teacher? I mean, I like to, some days I'm a special teacher. some days I'm just an ordinary teacher. I think the answer is sort of twofold. Yes, I do believe in a student-centered model. However, what I'm doing, for instance, with the book clubs, it's not purely student-centered. I am choosing the books. In a student-centered classroom, usually you're giving students some choice, and there's more of an emphasis on book clubs that are student-led and independent reading. And I do think that if you're reading classics, which I think kids should, that they need more teacher support than that. And so it becomes a little bit more teacher-centered. So I kind of believe in a continuum there between teacher-centered and student-centered work. And I think you need to be a dedicated teacher when you're practicing either mode. And I think there's no one way to be effective. So some people are more verbal than other people, and some people are more charismatic than other people. I think in the right school environment, teachers can play to their strengths and be excellent. I don't think that we have to choose one model over the other and stick with it completely to increase student achievement. So I don't think that there's a silver bullet. I don't think, we have to have more teacher-directed learning, or, oh, we have to have more student-centered learning. I do like a combination of the two. What I think is the main issue right now is that the testing is not meaningful. So it doesn't matter whether you're teacher-centered or student-centered if the test does not connect with the curriculum to begin with.
Thanks, Tony. Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I thought it somewhat appropriate, I hope, to start with a quote from Shakespeare. And this, our life exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything. I just had to say that because it's one of my favorite lines.
Thank you.
And where is that from?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a sonnet or if it's from one of his plays. I'm sorry. I just know the particular line. I have read some of Shakespeare, although I do find him a bit hard to swallow sometimes, a bit heady, just because of the language, the Elizabethan language. But I love his stuff. I'm calling because I think I'm an anomalous statistic and sort of pithy to the conversation. I didn't graduate from high school. I dropped out actually in my freshman year. It's a long story. I grew up in the foster care system, and I was, kind of a problem child, for lack of a better term. I'm the statistic you read about on all those, test scores and stuff. Right. But my exposure to a teacher as a foster parent, and particularly her love of reading and books. I remember the day I opened up The Hobbit. It was the first time I'd ever read a book that I hadn't been assigned by a teacher. And I fell in love with the story, and it changed, I'd have to say, I mean, it sounds a bit melodramatic, and I'm trying to be succinct, but it really did change my life. And then Anne of Green Gables, she had all the all these classic bits of literature, fiction, and I couldn't get enough reading. My point being that I'm 48 now, and the difference, I think, if I could be succinct in what I'm trying to say, is that learning was a chore, a requirement, something people told me I had to do and it was necessary. And being exposed to reading and being exposed to not just reading, but being able to express my opinion about what I was reading and my understanding of what I was reading with somebody else, having a conversation about it, made me want to learn. It made me lust after learning. And that has not changed in my 48 years of life, and I'm so grateful for that moment. And I've had ups and downs. I'm not saying there's any panacea, but I also agree with Claire in terms of the way we test seems to be about regurgitation and redundancy and remembering. And I get that kids have to learn basic skills, reading, arithmetic, you know, the old RRR. But if there's no passion for learning, it sort of ends there anyway, and it really doesn't measure what we're capable of. So I think there's like this need to balance the fact that we need to learn basic things combined with a need to balance that with the ability to explore and imagine other things that you can do, which is your capacity for learning. Finally, I want to end really quick, and I'm sorry I'm so long-winded, because I'm very passionate. It's hard to be sort of to the point, at least for me sometimes, when I get very excited about something, because I really believe in this topic as very important to a lot of things right now going on in our world. But the other side is I just want to tell you a story about a little girl, and it's very brief, and I won't name her name. But we were in the park one day. She's a neighbor's daughter, and she was climbing all over the jungle gym in the park, and she was just very fluid and very graceful. And I commented, I said to her, "Oh my God, you should be a gymnast." And she looked at me and she said, "What's a gymnast?" And she's 11 years old. Now, this young girl, I'm going to end with this and go off air. This young girl knew what a hoochie mama was, but she didn't know what a gymnast was. How can she dream of becoming a gymnast if she doesn't even know what one is?
Oh,
thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Lynn. That really drives home the point I'm trying to make about how diffuse the deficits are that children come to school with. And so every time we test them on knowledge that we simply think a seventh grader should have, we're exposing deficits that have nothing to do with what the child learned in school. For instance, they may have acquired some sophisticated vocabulary, but they don't know what a gymnast is. So then you're reading a passage about a gymnast on a standardized test, and guess what? You're completely lost. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly the point I'm trying to make. If you test the kids on what I can teach them, and we limit the knowledge we expect them to have, not to say that we don't expect them to continue to grow and for all of their deficits to magically go away. If we focus the knowledge we want them to have for each grade, I think we will be more successful in showing what our children have learned, and mm-hmm. it will be more fair to both the child and to the teachers. The other thing I think the caller touched on, the other element of teaching and learning that the caller touched on, is the human element. And, you know, you can tell when kids are feeling joy when they're reading. And a supervisor can tell that when they come into your classroom. And their supervisor can tell that when they come into the school. So schools can be assessed by human beings. And human beings can, you know, are very good at detecting joy. And tests are not.
Thank you very much, Lynn, for your story. I loved her story, too, of being in a house with books, and there it was, and she read the right thing, and it changed everything. We also want to let her know, and all of us know, Lynn, Brett, look this up. Your Shakespeare quote is from As You Like It. It's Act 2. So there we go. Thanks, Lynn, for the call. We have some lines open if you've been trying to get through. Our number is 800-486-8655. Claire Nadell Hollander, middle school public school teacher in New York City and author of the recent New York Times essay, Teach the Books, Touch the Heart. It was in the paper on Sunday, April 22nd, is our guest this hour. It's filled with ideas, and she's filled with ideas, too, that are worthy of our attention. Here are a couple of emails that have come in. One is Brian in Monona asks, how do you integrate the wonderful historic works of Black and Native American writers into your courses? Are there works that you teach, and why is it important?
That's a good question. Yes. I've often used Raisin in the Sun in my book groups. It's a play that is, although it's on serious topics about civil rights in this country, it's also got a lot of humor in it. So the kids love reading Raisin in the Sun. It's such a great portrait of a family and the ways that they interact, sometimes tragically, but also sometimes with a great deal of humor and resilience. The Native American literature question is interesting. I often use M. Scott Momedy's poems when I teach poetry, if you know his work. He's a very accessible poet. At the same time, his language is very beautiful and filled with imagery. And a contemporary book, not a classic, that I use that's the Native American perspective that's insanely popular with middle school students is Sherman Alexie's The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. I've used other Sherman Alexie stories as well. They're all ruthlessly concerned with identity, and the kids just are wild especially for part-time Indian. The only complaint I have about that book is I can't keep copies of it in the school because they're always taking them.
And we should, the Milwaukee Rep is doing Raisin in the Sun next season, just to put that in your head for those of you who love that as well. And I would be among those people. Ray in Oshkosh. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I'm studying to be an art teacher, and I was just wondering, how do these standardized tests, how would that affect me? I mean, and how would that affect the students, my students in the future? You know, are they going to be asked art history questions? I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks, Ray.
Well, they probably won't be asked art history questions about, you know, I wouldn't mind content-based testing. At least you know what you're supposed to teach them. I think, you know, as far as being an art teacher, I think the problem you face probably is the more emphasis there is on testing, the less concern there is for the arts and integrating the arts throughout the curriculum. And so I think how seriously you get to think about how their experiences in art might relate to project work that they do. I know in some schools you have beautiful project work based on the social studies curriculum or the literature curriculum, and there's less and less time to do that kind of work, that cross-disciplinary work.
Here's an interesting email from Norma. In 30 years of teaching at the college level, I found a shocking diminishment, not only in amount of reading students had done, but in the breadth of what they could have been expected to have encountered. An increasing number had never read any Shakespeare, for example, but many had read a lot of popular literature. Do you hear this, Claire, from college teachers?
Well, I haven't heard that specific complaint. Usually what I hear from college teachers is that the students have very poor writing skills. I think that can be attributed to some of the emphasis on the multiple choice testing. because even when these tests include written responses, they don't count as much as the multiple choice. So that's one issue. The not reading Shakespeare or classics may actually have another route. I don't know what the curriculum is like in your state, but in K through 8 here, there's a lot of emphasis on independent reading, which does lead the kids to read more popular fiction. That may relate back to the standardized testing in that it's taken on faith that the more books a kid reads, the better they'll do on the standardized tests. I haven't found that to be true when I look at the data I've looked at my own school. I don't see a correlation.
Mike in Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm a 66-year-old male, and I have a similar story as the lady that called that quoted Shakespeare. I basically flunked out of school because I didn't really know how to read. You could give me a book and I could pronounce all the words, but I had absolutely no idea what I read after I read it.
Mm.
And learning was just tremendously painful for me, or school was. Learning isn't, but school was tremendously painful for me. So I just dropped out, and I guess I'm pretty successful. I've had a career, and not in the Mitt Romney sense of being successful, but I did okay for myself. So I was just wondering how the reading is being taught, because I just don't understand why I didn't learn how to read the proper way when I was a youngster.
How were you taught, Mike? Do you remember?
Well, I think I, the Dick and Jane stories,
right?
I was taught some grammar, but maybe that was the problem. I didn't really understand what adjectives and nouns and pronouns. I knew I was taught that, but I didn't get it, and I guess the teacher thought I was a dummy because I kept failing, and I'm certainly no dummy.
Did you get the?
I got a GED when I was in the military, and I was successful in the military. I worked on fighter aircrafts. They thought I was smart enough to do that.
Yeah.
I sure didn't make it in high school.
Well, is that the way we need to teach reading, Claire? Adjectives and prepositions and all of that. Do we need that structural knowledge before we can get to the heart of what we're reading?
Well, that's interesting. I think for some children that enter school with either sort of a discrete learning disability in reading or a language deficit that may be caused by some factors in the home life, like you don't speak English at home. I think for a lot of those children, a little bit more attention to learning the grammar in the early grades and being attentive to it in middle school would be helpful, because kids with certain kinds of deficits don't use complex sentences very much. And if you think about it, the words that help us create complex sentences and complex thoughts are sort of themselves empty of much meaning. They're abstract. And so for a young child with language deficits or with reading language learning disability, words like therefore, in conclusion, furthermore, moreover, whereas, sounds like, cotton in their ears. So explicitly teaching what these types of words do and how they help form ideas, I think would help some children.
More phone calls in a moment. Claire Nadell Hollander, middle school public school teacher in New York City, author of the recent New York Times essay, Teach the Books, Touch the Heart, is our guest this hour. The article is in the April 22nd edition in that, I read it for so many years, is Week in Review. What's it called now? You know the section I'm talking about. Sunday, April 22nd. More phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our next caller is Joy on Highway 43. Hi, Joy.
Hello, how are you? Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the standardized testing. I work for a company that actually did some of the standardized testing. We scored. We didn't write the programs, but we did the scoring for many New York City schools about 5-6 years ago. But what I wanted to say is the multiple chat testing actually does teach, I think, at least getting an idea about what the kids are grasping and what they're not. Is it a wonderful way of testing? No. But I think that the schools don't really have an opportunity to gather enough information about what kind of knowledge the kids are getting without something like this. And when you get into the, you know, the essays on the standardized testing, those are very flawed, too, because you have people in who are testing for the answers, the essay answers, and they've got to cram these so many reports at once from all the kids who are supplying these. So, you know, someone might be a wonderful writer but still not score well. There are books we can read about that. But I think, you know, we need the standardized testing, but in addition to that, if the if we have these concerned teachers and parents who can get together with the book clubs and reading some of these classics, I think that would be a wonderful way to get kids more involved in the enjoyment of reading.
Claire.
Yeah, it was a little difficult to hear the caller, but I think I agree that the standardized tests do provide a baseline. My argument is they don't effectively measure growth if you're thinking about what the child learned that year in school. I think they do not really do that. I don't think they were even initially designed to do that. I think these standardized tests were initially designed to diagnose, to really determine who is struggling. And they do help with that. They certainly, if you're far below grade level on the test, there's something going on. But when you keep testing kids year after year and you're saying to their teachers, oh, he went down 5 points, he went down 35 points, he went down 50 points, and the assumption there is because that has to do with something that was not happening in that classroom, should have been, I think that's completely fallacious. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true at all.
Yeah.
I don't think that the tests can show that. I do think we could have multiple choice tests on books that are assigned.
Thank you, Joy, for the call. Karen in Madison, hi.
Hi. I didn't start reading the classics until I was in my early 40s, thinking they were fusty and old and had nothing to say to me. And what I've been shocked about is the universality of human experience. Psychology wasn't invented in the 20th century, and neither was writing about it. Dickens was fabulous about the person. And I keep looking in the front to see if a mistake has been made in the translation of some of these books. And it taught me that human beings were the same in the time of Aeschylus, they were the same in the time of Erasmus, and we were the same in the time of Dickens. And that was really a shock for me. And I don't think you would get that unless we read things that were written during those time periods.
Claire.
I agree completely. I think that's one of the most amazing things. And, you know, another thing that you realize, especially when you're reading classics with kids, is not only are they still relatable, but some of them are quite shocking. I mean, Shakespeare is shocking. And, you know, I explain the dirty jokes to the kids when they don't get them.
Thanks very much for the call.
There's a lot of them.
John writes, as a teacher, I've experienced the lack of worldliness or the desire for broad knowledge in today's students. The student who will be a computer whiz but can't find England on a world map or know what a gymnast is. They tell me they're only interested in knowledge that relates directly to them. Everything else is irrelevant.
You know, sometimes it's the questions you ask, especially with adolescents, and they can be so dismissive of certain subjects and knowledge that you're excited about.
it can hurt your feelings terribly. On the other hand, they can be amazingly just voracious for knowledge that really doesn't relate to them directly. I think they're interested in certain topics, depending on how old the child is that you're talking about. I mean, I think young children are fairly open. I think adolescents, you're very focused on certain concepts, certain ideas like freedom or fairness. These are...
or love. They're interested in love, too, aren't they?
Love, yeah. They're interested in love and loneliness, the flip side of it.
Yeah. Claire, we're out of time, so I need to say goodbye to you. I'm sorry, I just got so captivated here. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you so much
for having
me.
I'm glad you did. Yeah, our great pleasure. Claire Nadel Hollander, public school teacher. She teaches middle school in New York City, and we direct your attention to her essay in the New York Times, April 22nd, Teach the Books, Touch the Heart. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Brett as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. Great conversations ahead.